Good evening. This is Mimi Poser at the Guggenheim. Several weeks ago, we did a program on legal problems in the arts. The subject is so wide-ranging that we invited back the panel to continue the discussion. Our guests are once again Frieda Mindlin, administrator of the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts, Michael Pantaleone, lawyer and former executive director of the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts, or am I anticipating?
That's correct.
That's correct. And Howard Thorkelson, lawyer and research director of the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts. Joining us this evening is Franklin Feldman, who participated in another program on this same subject some time ago. Mr. Feldman, also a lawyer, is president of the International Foundation for Art Research and is co-author of a book, the title of which is Artworks, Law, Policy Practices. Mr. Feldman is, in addition, a practicing artist. Good evening and welcome to you all.
Good evening, Mimi. I'd like to add one other thing, is that Mr. Feldman is also a member of the Board of Advisors to Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts.
I had so much to say about Mr. Feldman, I had to edit. Frieda, the last time we were together, you made a remark which, in a sense, astonished me, and then when I thought about it, it didn't astonish me at all. I'd like to share that thought with the audience and with our panel and talk about it. You said that artists themselves were quite reluctant to do anything to protect themselves.
Yes, they're reluctant to use the copyright sign on their paintings. I think to the artist it smacks of commercialism and they feel it detracts from their art. I think the resistance is based right there. And somehow I think they have to be led to believe that protecting themselves and being perhaps commercial in the long run is not a bad thing. It just makes good business sense.
Is that the only area that they're reluctant?
Can I interject?
Sure.
It goes a little bit beyond that in my experience, Mimi. Many artists are reluctant to exchange information among one another as to contractual arrangements or arrangements that they have achieved with various galleries. So there's no common source of knowledge as to what gallery owners may be willing to agree to in the consignment of works or other types of arrangements. Artists are also reluctant to seek legal advice for assistance in coming to arrangements for the sale of their works. All of this is important, and artists are not expected, nor should they be expected, to act as their own lawyers.
Well, you know, let me interrupt you and say the reason it astonished me when Frieda first said it was because so many people talk today about how commercial some artists have become. So I think we ought to try to narrow down, who are the artists? Are these the young artists, the unknown artists, or are they the greats who just feel they don't need it? Because we do know a lot of artists who are thoroughly commercial. And know all the ins and outs and have lawyers, accountants, et cetera, mm-hmm. on their staffs.
Frank, but Mimi, I think there's a separate question. I think mm-hmm. the first question is whether or not lawyers or artists are reluctant to join together. And I think that is very true. For example, Artist Equity, which is the artist organization, so to speak, is a very weak organization, does not have most of the successful artists joining it. With respect to artists becoming commercial, I think that's absolutely a different problem, and it's actually the other side of the coin. Mm-hmm. That is to say, when artists become commercial, they are exploiting themselves. They're not joining with others. They're doing what they think will augment their own careers and so forth. I think it's an absolute paradox, but it's really the reverse of the same coin, in my judgment.
That's correct. There have been several attempts to organize artists by artists themselves, and they've all fallen short of their goals, and quite tragically so. The strength, just artist equity's strength or lack of strength, is the example that bodes well. The difficulty in legislation or reform legislation that is coming into Congress for deduction to enable artists to take deductions on the donations of their artworks or for artist royalty rights. Another case in point.
I make one other comment with respect to that. I think that one of the implications, and I think possibly the sad implication, is that because of this void, persons who come to the front to speak for the artists are not those persons who are best equipped to speak for the artists. They're not the artists' best agents, in my judgment. They are asking artists to join together, not always for the artist's best interest, as I see it.
Well, who are these people?
Well, I don't think there's any purpose in naming them, but I think they are non-artists, professionals, who believe they have certain solutions which will solve artists' problems. In my judgment, they're not going to solve serious problems.
Let's talk about some of these solutions. The last time we touched on the classical problem of the artist who sells his work for very little money and then sees it going up at auction for a lot of money and sees it changing hands, and he doesn't participate in the increased value. Now, one of the solutions is royalties. Would you explain royalties and the pros and cons? I know, Michael, you have some reservations about the royalty proposal. I'd like you to talk about that again.
Okay, I'll explain. Basically, a royalty is a very simple concept. If, as it's been proposed in this country, is that upon the sale of a work, the artist would retain a right to share in some percentage on the increased price of the work upon its resale. That basically is the royalty. It's called a royalty. There's a French expression called droit de suite, but essentially they all mean the same thing, though it is not patterned after what currently is the French practice. My reservations are based on ignorance, quite frankly, because I don't know to what extent I don't know the number of living artists who would benefit by this arrangement. We all know of the Rauschenbergs and the Warhols and the Motherwells who have achieved immense success. But how many working artists are there today in this country? And of that number, how many are going to be in a position where this practice would materially benefit them? My reluctance to become enthusiastic about this proposal at this point is because it takes an enormous effort to pass legislation or to correct a problem, particularly one as broad as this. And this legislation will sap the efforts in other areas that I think are, to my mind at the moment, are more important. And these are to look into ways to benefit artists or to assist or to benefit the climate under which artists who are not so commercially successful, so that they can be able to live off their work.
Well, now you're getting into the area of subsidies and grants.
I'd like to avoid that area for now because that's not what we're talking about. But primarily, my reluctance or my to embrace the royalty concept at this moment is based because I don't know to what extent it will help the artists I'm concerned with, and those are the ones who have not achieved great success commercially.
Howard and Frank, how do you feel about that?
Howard, do you want to?
Well, I certainly agree with Michael on his point as to the effects, the need and the effects of any legislation that might be enacted to implement a royalty system in this country. I think in order to reach some common judgment about the merits of a royalty system and otherwise, we need to know a lot more about the economic position of the artist than we do now. There just is hardly any place to turn for good information on that subject. I would make one slight distinction from what Michael said, which is that legislation is not the only method that artists have taken to try to achieve a relationship with collectors and galleries that would include the royalty principle. Contracts are another means, and obviously anybody in that situation is entitled to negotiate for whatever he can get. And it seems to me that the royalty principle is something of a battle cry now, that it's of some value in bringing artists together. I think it has been advanced mainly so far by the artists at the who are most conspicuous, who are most in the public view, and who have achieved the greatest financial success so far. But that's not exclusively true.
Well, it seems to me that there's almost a dual problem here, that the artists who are not famous and are not getting big prices for their works fall into a quite different category, and that some protection, or perhaps some different kind of protection, is necessary for them, and perhaps the well-known, wealthy artists don't need such protection. Frank, what are your feelings on this subject?
In brief, let me say that I agree completely with what Michael has said. I do not think the so-called royalty proposal makes any real sense for the artist. And I want to focus on the way it's really supposed to work, because people talk about this as if it's some sort of panacea, and I think it is not. The current proposals, which are discussed most widely, are those which relate to sharing a portion of the incremental value. Thus, if an artist sold a work for $1,000 some years ago, and now it's resold for $21,000, there's a profit of $20,000, and the artist is to share, and the figure normally given is 15% of that $20,000, or $3,000. What is often overlooked in these discussions is any precise analysis of what does this really mean in terms of the tax impacts that are present. And once you start analyzing that, and that is to say that the collector must now pay out of a portion of his profit a capital gains, and hopefully he's only paying capital gains being a collector, 30% of the profit, which is say an average rate, it could be lower than that, but let's use that as the rate because that's the rate that is sometimes used in analyzing the figures, would go to United States in capital gains taxes. That means that of the balance, the collector is paying 70% of the portion payable to the artist, because the artist is getting the difference between the cost and the total resale price. In other words, he's not saying to the collector, first figure your taxes, and then I'll share 30% of the balance, and that is not discussed. I went back recently to look at the so-called Projansky agreement. Projansky is a lawyer who helped draft an agreement for Mr. Siegelaub, who's a collector, and it's known as the Projansky or the Siegelaub agreement, to see whether or not the percentage was to be taken on an after-tax benefit or on a pre-tax benefit. It's clear it's on the pre-tax. Well, if that's so, then the collector is paying one hell of a bite of this amount. And it seems to me that collectors are just going to resist when their advisors say, do you understand what this means? At this rate, it means the collector is paying 70% of this. And I think that once the implications are known, the effect on sales will be chilling. And I think the wrong people are the ones who will be protected, and also the wrong ones be hurt.
What adds to the chill, Frank, is that there's no assurance that the art will increase in value.
Right, but it might affect the sale
but
now.
It might affect the sale now.
That's exactly,
correct.
Right.
Well, then, what are some of the alternatives? Frieda, you wanted to say something.
I don't know what the alternatives might be, but I do think that it's very hard to enforce such a thing. It's very hard to keep track of what's being sold and what's...
Yes, you'd have to have a whole regulatory body.
That's right. So it's very difficult. And also, it is the wrong people that will benefit in the end. It's not the struggling artist. It's the more affluent artist. And they don't need that kind of help.
I agree.
At the expense of the collector.
Right. I agree with that completely. In terms of enforcement, if you have a system which is based on incremental value, well, I don't want to say it's impossible to enforce. The difficulties of enforcement are so great. I mean, people refer to ASCAP. Well, ASCAP is not an answer to a system like this. ASCAP doesn't go into incremental value. Now, France is a little wiser. They don't have the so-called tax, this royalty, on incremental value. It's off the top. It's 3% off the top. And it only applies to auction sales and subsequently was extended in 1957 to sales by galleries. Still doesn't cover private sales between Mr. X and Mr. Y, if the resale is to Mr. Y. Well, it's much easier. There you're collecting a sales tax. the auction house or the gallery simply collects out of the proceeds of the sale, so really the seller is paying at 3%. That you can enforce. But to start saying, how much did you pay for it years ago? I don't know how many collectors would even remember, have the records. I think it's a mistake.
Howard.
What would you think, Frank, of a system involving a special tax on the sale of artworks? Either a special tax or the reservation of some part of the proceeds.
I think that's what the French system is, and I can see a dialogue on that point, and I probably would be in favor of it.
Well, as I understand it, the French system has been on the books for about 25 or 26 years now, and that it doesn't work as well as it should. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I've heard different views as to how much it works. I recently seen a figure which indicated that they have collected about 1 million francs, and I believe that's per annum. That's about $250,000.
I'd understood that in terms of auction sales, some auctions that had been held in France are now being held in Switzerland or London to avoid even the minor, 5%?
3%
tax, yeah.
Right. Sure, there's no question it will start pushing sales to jurisdictions where the tax is lower, as we have with sales tax.
Before we leave this subject, again, as I understand it, there has been, as part of this proposal, one issue that the heirs of the artist should also, for instance, a widow or children, should be entitled to some portion of any increment in the value of the work.
I think that is not really any different from the basic principle. You have to decide, do you want to give the artist the benefit? Once you pass that, then I think it's a simple question to say, well, does it extend to the widow? Does it extend to a prior
wife?
What
are your feelings about that?
I think that's such a minor question in terms of, it's the main question, do you want to have the system at all for the artist? I think once you say yes, then I don't think it's any problem extending it to the widow. And the question is duration.
Yeah, it becomes an emotional question when you bring in a widow. And so it's Frank's not trying to be callous by saying it's a minor question, but the fact is, legally it is. The basic question is, does the right exist? And then does it exist to the artist's estate or whatever? But the basic question has to be answered. The problem, which Frank alluded to, is that, and Frida had mentioned, is that the issue has become so emotional that it's being adopted in principle without looking into the tax problems or into the marketability of artworks or into the effect that it might have on artists who cannot command significant prices.
Well, all right, now have any of you come up with any alternate proposals, or has anybody come up with an alternate proposal?
Well, I think what Howard suggested, which is to include something in the contract between the artist and the collector, makes a lot more sense, rather than having some kind of universal law that has to be adhered to. And I think that makes a great deal of sense. I think maybe we can start working on some kind of contract, some kind of model contract, not like the Prajansky contract, but something that would give one many more options. I think that would be an alternative.
In other words, a bargaining,
yes.
Bargaining power. All right, now, let's go to a different subject. What about protection of the artist's work once it's sold, once it's in the hands of the owner?
Well, I'll outline what I think are two areas when you talk about protection. One is protection to the right to the content of the work itself, which is generally protected by copyright. And the other is the right to what sometimes is called the integrity of the work, which again borrows a concept that in the French term is called droit moral.
Do you mean by integrity of the work, not altering it?
That's correct. Not altering it, not painting a mustache on a portrait, or putting
a
glow of
orange. Let me ask
you
if one other thing fits into this category. Using the work of art once it's sold for a purpose which the artist would not like it to be used for. For instance, somebody buys a painting and sells bags of flowers and has that painting reproduced on his bag of flour, which would be very much against what the artist would want. Is that part of the same thing?
Well, you've merged both of those areas. The first is in
No, I asked you if I could.
You could. Well, that would depend on whether the artist had copyrighted the work. Whether, if he had copyrighted the work, the collector, in the absence of an assignment of that copyright, could not make copies of it. But if the artist had not established a claim of copyright to the work, in every state but New York, under the current law, you can make copies of it and do with it as you will. The entire, generally entire dominion to the work goes upon the sale to the owner. And that gives rise to a host of problems, one of which was in, I believe, at Art News, on the David Smith estate, mm-hmm. where one of the executors had altered some of the pieces that the estate was still retained, and has been received with some criticism. And there's some excellent discussion on that in Frank's book and in Artworks, with some suggestions as to possible consequences or legal consequences, as well as the marketability of the work itself.
Frank, would you talk about that?
Well, I think the concept that is being discussed, the so-called moral right, is a very complicated concept. Let me begin with that first. As such, it is not recognized here. That is, there is no law or doctrine of moral right in American law. However, in various other formats, parts of that right have been recognized. And various cases have recognized under the law of unfair competition, palming off, being identified with the work, and the like. I think the David Smith situation, which has been discussed in recent art magazines, also raises other very significant problems in terms of an executor's responsibility under a will to the beneficiaries. What are his responsibilities? What are his responsibilities to a nonprofit foundation, which might exist? I think these are very serious problems that relate to that situation and not to the others. There's also another problem. If someone is named an executor in a will, and that could be an artist as well as a lawyer, what is your obligations vis-a-vis the other executor? I mean, here we have a situation where there are three executors. One is an art critic, art writer, another is an artist, another is a lawyer. Can the other two, who do not have as strong views as Mr. Greenberg, say, well, you decide, you want to paint over the sculpture, go ahead if that's what you think is best? Don't they have a certain obligation, a very serious obligation, perhaps to get independent advice? What about the wishes of the testator? Are they required to really find out what would he have wanted? Can they simply just sit back and say, well, he knows more than we do?
Frank, can I ask a question? Yes. To go a little bit broader? If an artist sells a work, and an artist, say, who has the same feelings towards his work as David Smith did, obviously did, mm-hmm. Does he have any rights to the integrity of his work to prevent the work from being altered or melted down or held up to display a commercial product? Does the artist have any right to follow after that?
I think the law today would give him certain rights under certain ideal situations. As you know, in our book, we reproduced the case Crimmy against Rutgers Presbyterian Church. There, a person who painted a mural for a church found out subsequently that when the congregation had changed of the church and wished to paint over his mural, he tried to stop them, and he lost. The court held that the church owned the work. He took the risk that the people who control that church would change. They might not like his mural subsequently, and they owned the work. And he had no essential moral right to say, no, that work must remain in its pristine form forever.
But that was a case of complete obliteration.
Yes, it was. Right.
Well,
that's correct. That is
this
right.
This is practically historical,
that is correct.
Too. Right. You know, we all know the cases mm-hmm. of Michelangelo's
well,
having
right. No, but I think Howard's point is correct. Suppose they had changed some of the faces. Suppose they had marked out his name and put the name of a congregant, the president of the congregation, so to speak, who decided that he wanted to have his name. Could the artist have said, no, that, you know, you may own the work, but that's my name and that's my work, and I have a certain paternity to the work.
Those are different issues.
I'm
right?
very sorry, but astonishingly enough, our time has run out once again.
Once again.
So I'd like to thank Frieda Mindlin.
Thank you.
Michael Pantaleone, Howard Thorkelson, and Franklin Feldman for having been with us again this evening. And to our audience, good night and thank you.